Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
As Mrs. Kennedy now gets into the car, and the president does, the other man in the car is the governor of Texas, and the Secret Service men are now getting in the driver and the front seat.
On that fateful day when President and Mrs. Kennedy got into X-100, what the Secret Service called the 1961 Lincoln Continental that would take them into downtown Dallas, the top was down. It had turned into a beautiful day, and now the President and First Lady would be easily seen by the big and friendly crowds that had gathered to see them. Some conspiracy buffs think this was fishy, but this was the way that Kennedy always preferred it. After all, politicians like to be seen, and besides, that was the way, in that more innocent era, it had always been, not just for John F. Kennedy, but all presidents. I'm Paul Brandis. You're listening to Countdown to Dallas, a podcast series based on my book of the same title. These days, presidential security is suffocating. Layer upon layer of security, and the vehicle that presidents ride around in is heavily armored with numerous security features that cannot be named. The Secret Service calls its vehicle Stagecoach, but most folks call it the Beast. This was not always the case. Prior to Dallas, security was far looser, as was the attitude that most presidents had towards it. Let's go back in time for a moment. Even after the assassinations of Abraham Lincoln in 1865 and James Garfield 18 years later, the White House was an open building. Members of the public could simply stroll right in. This was tightened in the mid-1890s. But President William McKinley loosened it, ordering guard boxes around the White House removed. He also enjoyed taking solitary walks. On August 27, 1901, the Washington Post warned of an assassination plot against McKinley. The president scoffed. 17 days later, he was dead after being shot by an anarchist named Leon Czolgosz in Buffalo, New York. By the way, that story has a strange twist that would resurface 3 hours before President Kennedy's murder. Stay tuned for that down the road. Anyway, even after the McKinley assassination, his successor, Theodore Roosevelt, continued to move about in the open. Open carriages and open cars were the norm. This was also the case for Presidents Woodrow Wilson, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. This brings us to 1933.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That, of course, Franklin D. Roosevelt being sworn in as the 32nd president. It was March 4th, 1933. It was a miracle that he was even alive.
Mr. Mayor, my friends of Miami, I am not a stranger here.
Just 17 days earlier in Miami, he survived an assassination attempt when a gunman opened fire on his open car. The president-elect was not hit, but five people were, including Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak. I'm glad it was me, not you, a fatally wounded Cermak whispered to FDR as they sped to a hospital. Imagine how different our world would be today had Franklin D. Roosevelt been killed that night in Miami. You'd think it would have changed security around FDR, but no. Paul Sparrow, for many years, was director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum in Hyde Park, New York.
So even before he was president, FDR, in an open-top car, was almost assassinated. So you would think going into his presidency, in a period in which America was harshly divided and suffering the worst economic crisis in American history, and a lot of people really hated FDR, he refused to ride in closed cars unless the weather demanded it. He had open-top cars that he traveled around the country in 1933 throughout his whole presidency. When he would travel on trains across the country, he would get out on the back porch. So he had these Pullman cars that were specially modified for him. They had these little elevators in the back that would raise and lower him in his wheelchair, and he would stand on the back and wave to people. And there was very little security presented to protect him from potential assassination.
And speaking of security threats, most folks don't know this, but there was even a plot in 1933 to overthrow Roosevelt involving big business leaders and a retired Marine Corps general with a militia to back them up. The plot was discovered and broken up, but it shows just how deep the hatred of Roosevelt was in conservative circles. Now, a minute ago, Sparrow mentioned that even an actual assassination attempt did not keep FDR from riding around in the open. What about the cars he rode in? For the first 6 years of his presidency, he theoretically was a sitting duck. It was only in 1939 that the government bought the famous Sunshine Special. It was armored, yes, but FDR always wanted the top down.
The car that he drove in the first part of his presidency was an open car. And the Sunshine Special was built in 1939. And again, it was armored and used, but it was also a convertible. And he often drove around it with his top down.
With regards to the Kennedy assassination, what about the charge by conspiracy buffs that it was also fishy that Kennedy was allowed to be driven underneath tall buildings with open windows? Surely that was unusual. Not really.
Now the procession through the metropolis in a downpour of rain, which Mr. Roosevelt braves in an open car.
Just to give one example, Sparrow points to this October 1944 visit to New York City, where the president was driven beneath block after block of Manhattan skyscrapers in an open car.
It was not uncommon for them to publicize his route and the times that he would be there so that people would come out and show their support for him. And again, the war had started in Europe at this point. This was prior to Pearl Harbor, so we weren't in the war yet. But certainly hostilities were high. The danger was high. There were no Nazi agents and provocateurs in Manhattan. So it was a risky venture.
And what of the charge that Secret Service agents in Dallas rode behind Kennedy's car? Unusual, right? Again, note Sparrow.
I think it depended partly on how fast the cars were going to be going. So if they were going slowly through an urban area and they were crowds expected, and so FDR wanted to be able to wave to the crowds, they would generally not ride on the running boards of the car because they didn't want to obstruct the view. They would be in the car behind it.
Anyway, we could discuss FDR at length here, but what about the two presidents between Roosevelt and Kennedy?
4 inches of snow failed to keep President Truman from his customary morning constitutional. Home for the holidays in Independence, Missouri, Mr. Truman bounces off at 8:10, just 10 minutes later than usual.
No matter where he was, Harry Truman went for a walk just about every morning, completely out in the open, and as the announcer said, usually at 8 o'clock on the dot. Truman usually walked with an agent by his side and others were nearby, but the dangerous, undeniable fact was that the President of the United States was out in the open each morning on public streets, and anyone walking down the sidewalk could have gotten unacceptably close to him. Newsreel show the president even waiting at stoplights to cross and talking with whoever was on the corner. All this made agents so nervous that they began rigging traffic lights on his usual route to turn green so he wouldn't have to stop. When Truman found out about that, he complained that they were ruining his walks. Like I've said, prior to Dallas, it was a different era and a miracle that nothing happened.
More Countdown to Dallas right after this quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
Then one brisk November day in 1950, something did.
Outside Blair House, the president's temporary Washington home, extreme fanatics of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party try to force their way in, guns blazing, to assassinate the president of the United States.
One assassin was killed, another wounded. The attack also took the life of White House policeman Leslie Kofelt. Now, if you've ever seen Blair House, it's right on the Pennsylvania Avenue sidewalk. Truman, who'd been taking a nap, was awakened by the gunfire and rushed to the window. A passerby, seeing the president's face peering down as the battle erupted, shouted, "Get back, get back!" The president was lucky. Instead of shooting their way into Blair House, the gunmen simply could have waited 20 minutes to attack Truman when he came out of Blair House to leave for an event. This was public information, after all. The president's schedule had been published, as usual, in the morning newspapers. After the attempt on Truman's life, security was tightened, but then eased as security fears subsided. David Clark is archivist at the Truman Presidential Library and Museum in Independence, Missouri. He tells me that the president continued to walk around in the open each morning. In fact, he insisted on doing so. Like Roosevelt, Truman also insisted on open cars so he could be seen, tall buildings and open windows notwithstanding. And there are plenty of photos showing that, as was often but not always the case, Secret Service agents were positioned well behind the president's car.
I, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear that you
After riding through his 1953 inaugural without going President Truman, both men in an open car, as it rode along Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol, Dwight D. Eisenhower would spend the next 8 years in similar fashion, open cars and often standing up so crowds could get a better view. Like Roosevelt and Truman, open cars were quite normal for Eisenhower. This was true even when he was abroad, where the security environment was more questionable. For example, in December 1959, Eisenhower made a long trip to Europe, the Middle East, India, and Africa, a dozen countries in 18 days.
Ike rides with President Ayub in an open estate carriage drawn by 6 horses and escorted by a crack mounted guard.
Lots of open vehicles, even, for example, a slow-moving horse-drawn carriage in Pakistan in which Eisenhower stood up.
As the two presidents ride in from the airport, half the city's population lines the streets and crowds the windows and balconies of every building.
Tall buildings, open windows, standing up in a slow, horse-drawn carriage. In Afghanistan the next day, huge crowds pressing in on the president's slow-moving car. One Secret Service agent, Clint Hill, we'll be hearing about him later, told me about that trip. He also wrote about it, saying, quote, being exposed to massive crowds in a slow-moving open vehicle accentuated the dangers that the president was placed in, unquote. India, Iran, on, the same kind of security. The president's final stop was Morocco.
More than 500,000 Moroccans lined the way into Casablanca.
The president again stood up most of the way in the often slow-moving convertible. Suddenly, though, gunfire erupted. Jubilant bystanders were firing rifles into the air in celebration, a tribute to the visiting president. But what if just one of those gunmen had acted differently? I've devoted this episode to a look at security prior to the Kennedy assassination for this reason. It is important to place events of that terrible day in Dallas in broader context. There are those who think it's somehow fishy that JFK rode through Dallas in an open, slow-moving car. They think it's suspicious that his Secret Service agents were relegated to the follow-up vehicle and that were tall buildings and open windows. But history tells us otherwise. Each of Kennedy's predecessors, every one of them, often rode around in the open, placing themselves at heightened risk. Sometimes Secret Service agents were beside or behind the presidential vehicle, but in many cases, they were not. That a motorcade was traveling slowly down a street surrounded by tall or tallish buildings with countless open windows didn't seem to make much of a difference. All of this, again, reflects what I call a more innocent era. That's the title of one chapter of my book. But there's more to all of this. We're all going to die one day, of course, but presidents often think of their mortality a bit differently. Let's return to my friend Paul Sparrow, again, the longtime director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum in Hyde Park, New York. President Kennedy often had thoughts of death the morning of his very assassination. In fact, he joked about how easy it would be to kill him, that kind of thing. He sort of had a death wish, and even predicted at one point in his life, he had all kinds of health issues, as people now understand, that he would not live beyond the age of 45. He was off by about a year and a half. Did he ever discuss that kind of thing? Did he ever discuss the issue of assassination or somebody actually getting to him, as you mentioned, was nearly the case in Miami? What did he say about that?
Well, it's a very interesting question because there are several different components of FDR's philosophy about mortality. Because he suffered from polio and came so close to death, because he devoted many years of his life to try to recover from the effects of polio, which nearly paralyzed him from the waist down, it had other physical repercussions. I think from that point forward, he had a very simplistic view of that, which is that if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. I'm going to live my life to the fullest. I'm not going to allow these handicaps to prevent me from achieving what I want to achieve. So in some ways, he was fearless about his personal safety.
What, if anything, does that tell you about presidents in general? Again, I'm going only up to Dallas here. Presidents and their security, it seems like they were all fearless and sort of laughed in the face of potential harm.
Well, I think almost anyone who rises to the level of running for president of the United States has a certain sense of invulnerability, that they believe that they're special. They believe that, you know, they are on a mission in a sense. And so I think a lot of them feel that there is a fatalistic approach to this, which is that if someone wants to kill me, they're going to kill me. There's almost nothing I can do to prevent it. And this goes all the way back. Lincoln, even prior to Lincoln, presidents knew that if someone wanted to kill them, they could. But I think the ignoring the danger was also a reflection of our society back then. Guns back then were not the way they are today. You didn't have mass shootings on a regular basis. You didn't have assault-style military weapons in the hands of millions of citizens, many of whom, you know, believe in the right to own whatever weapons they want, but some of them are mentally and emotionally unstable. That didn't exist. I mean, it just did not exist during this time. And so people felt, particularly presidents and people like them, that they weren't in that much danger, and that the danger they were in was almost unpreventable. So I think that all of them took the same approach, which is that I'm the president of the United States. I represent the people of the United States. I have a responsibility to interact with them, to let them see me, to talk to them, to hear what they have to say. And so that retail politics, if you will, the getting out and touching the flesh is something that's very important to a politician who wants to be successful. But also I think when you reach that pinnacle of power in this country, the presidency, there's a special responsibility that you not get sucked into the bubble and completely cut off from the real world, and that those opportunities to interact with the public are vitally important to maintaining your balance in what's, you know, a very, very difficult job.
In our next episode, the week before Dallas, lots of things to mention. The final Texas details are worked out. Jacqueline Kennedy picks out what would soon be, arguably, the most famous article of clothing in American history. And in New York, the Secret Service draws its weapons during a motorcade. If you like this podcast, check out my book of the same title, Countdown to Dallas. Thanks to Paul Sparrow. Sound from the National Archives, CBS News, WFAA Radio, and the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas. Our editor and producer, Aaron Lamb. Audio engineer, Sean Rule Hoffman. Executive producers, Michael DeAloia and Gerardo Orlando. I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks so much for listening.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.